If you enjoy the harrowing of Minerva Damson and want to join the Order of Joan in their fight against the monsters stalking the trenches, there are several ways you can support the war effort. Find us on Patreon and enlist, or donate to the Order on Acast. You can also connect with Order headquarters via Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Links can be found in our bio. The Harrowing of Minerva Damson is a horror podcast and contains descriptions of war that some may find graphic or disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, fellow knights. The release of this week's Goliad Gabby episode will unfortunately be postponed due to travel interruptions, summer lawn mowing, and holiday fireworks creating difficult recording and editing conditions. However, while we're here, we thought we might make another announcement. We've decided to release the first episode of our Patreon Maiden Tier exclusive miniseries, The Delilah Documents, to our general audiences for free. We hope you like it. And if you want to hear more and keep up with subsequent episodes, head on over to our Patreon and check out our Maiden Tier. The Delilah Documents is only one of many perks for our wonderful Night Maidens. Thank you for your support and patience. We'll be back next week with the second episode of Goliad Gabby. All right. The date is April 22nd, 1933. This is Marian Dixon, sister scribe of the First Order based in the Order of St. Catherine Cloister of Boise, tasked by Magistra Yakandika with recording these archived documents Boston headquarters sent us for some reason into an audio format for posterity and information fidelity. Most of them are old war records that contain statement transcripts taken down during routine night debriefings, with a few supporting statements given by civilians and soldiers sprinkled in here and there, just for fun. Frankly, there's very little organization, except for the fact that so far, these are all restricted to the European theater. Within that very broad context, files have no particular order. They jump around by date and geographic location. I mean, heck, statements given by the same knight for different missions are scattered throughout the boxes. So, I'm 6 months into this project and about to open the 23rd box out of a collection of 59 total. This one is labeled D-West and East. Very helpful. Well, let's get to it then. First item is a file labeled Podbrzova, 1916. Debriefing of a Delilah S. No surname or rank. Must have been a civilian then. Given on December 13th, 1916, at the St. Gallen outpost to Councilwoman Stadler and Magistrix Aragon? This is very unusual. Usually it's sister superiors that take down statements. No one's so high profile as a councilwoman and a magistra. The statement begins, I began work as a secretary at the Zolyombreso Ironworks in Podbrzova in November 1915. It's a small community. I lived there with my second cousin and his family, which is perhaps one reason I was accepted so easily. There were already rumors that the ironworks were doing more than just making weapons for the war effort. People in town spoke of strangers being housed near Zolyombreso, who were thought to be magicians, and the wives of some ironworkers said their husbands were working long hours and coming home drained. They described it like this. Their husbands would arrive home in a daze and shuffle around slowly, almost as though they were sleepwalking. They didn't seem to be drinking much at the local bar either, so that couldn't explain their torpor. They didn't remember much of their work, and at first the women chalked it up to exhaustion. But one woman's husband came home one evening in an outright panic, raving about the men who trapped their memories in a mirror, and the strange molds they were instructed to make and fill in such a way. The women had all noticed cuts on their husbands that were slow to heal, but this man said he had been bled on purpose.
She was scared by his distress, so when doctors came to take her husband to the hospital where he could be treated and rest up, she thought nothing of it. But he never came back, and no one knew where he went. He certainly never arrived at the hospital. At first, I had to be careful not to go too near the production floor of the ironworks. My position was not one that would let me wander freely without being noticed, but I was sent to the production floor one day when my boss could not get away from a meeting to fetch one of the supervisors. I struck up a conversation with that supervisor, and he mentioned how he was so busy he hardly ever ate lunch anymore. The next day, I brought him a good, filling lunch in a basket, and I did the same every day from then on. Slowly, I got acquainted with his work colleagues and began bringing them lunches, too. After 6 months, I met the first sorcerer. Though he did not know, I knew him for what he was. He was a middle-aged man and lonely, I think. We flirted, and he was very eager to please me and show off. So it was that I first saw the pieces of what they were making. He showed me two molds one afternoon when the other sorcerers had taken their lunch in town. He told me it was for special helmets and armored chest pieces, thinking I wouldn't know any better, no doubt. But I could see where they were supposed to join, and that they really were too big to fit the average soldier. There were also impressions of symbols in the cast. I didn't know what language they were, but I recognized their significance. These sorcerers were making constructs of men, metal shaped like soldiers who would feel no fear nor remorse, and who would have no will but their masters. Not everyone in the factory worked on this project. Most of the workers were making the normal things, artillery and helmets and such. These men seemed perfectly healthy. I began to make friends with some of them, too. They knew as much about the project and its workers as the workers' wives, but they knew enough to be concerned by it. They were wary of the sorcerers and avoided them at all costs. But they explained to me the process of working iron into steel, and I would ask questions that would make them feel important and simultaneously make them doubt my intelligence. I kept up my flirtation with the sorcerer and ingratiated myself to one or two more of their number. Their names were Peter Chorney, Florin Rotherieu, and Stefan Huber, if those were their real names at all. I think they all assumed that if I got too close to things, they could steal my memory with their magic mirror contraption. I never saw it myself, so I cannot describe it here, unfortunately. Or maybe they thought they could just outright kill me if I proved too insightful. I never gave them cause to worry, though. They successfully activated the first construct in September and tested it. First, they tested its resistance to the more common weapons of this war, various calibers of bullets and artillery blasts and whatnot. Then, they wanted to see how destructive it could be. While they never said they were testing a construct in front of me, they did talk about the weapon with great excitement. And from these conversations both had and overheard, I surmised that they would begin production of more immediately, at least a platoon's worth. They began pulling more workers off of other projects to work this one, not only because they needed the additional manpower, but they needed their blood too, for the making and quenching of the steel they were using. Production was ticking up across the board, and the ironworkers were all working late. My work had previously been confined to the daytime, but I began bringing the men quick suppers after my work was done. The other wives began helping me. I considered poisoning the construct's steel with sulfur, which would make the final product brittle. But I couldn't think of a way to smuggle the quantities of impurities needed into the giant ladles where the molten metal was kept. Anyway, it would have only weakened the alloy. The constructs could still mete out plenty of damage before a lucky strike broke them. In the end, during the evenings when the men would take breaks to eat with their wives, I gathered bits of steel scraps from the factory floor, little cutoffs from the casting and machining process, or pieces that had accidentally fallen on the factory floor and hardened. I only ever managed to get into the construct project's manufacturing space once. It was always guarded at night. The sorcerers never worked past 9, even at their busiest. And one night I convinced the guard's sweetheart to bring him some supper. They stepped away for a minute together, and I was able to slip in and out with the scraps. I saw the constructs in various stages of completion when I was in there. Each one was 6 feet tall and hollow inside, with articulated joints and script molded into their faces and chests. I still couldn't recognize the script, and I couldn't stay long enough to get a better look or get a good rubbing. Once I had enough scraps, I built a furnace on the far side of my cousin's farm in the old barn, melted all the pieces together, and poured them into toy soldier molds. I made 50 in total, one for every construct I believe was made. That's what I've brought you. Done with the right spells, melting them should destroy the construct platoon. That was the best I could do with what I had and with so few resources. Well, that's the end of her statement, but it looks like there's an addendum. Toy soldiers entered the possession of the Winterher Post December 28, 1916. Reports of metal golems deployed in combat in Marești, Romania, on July 22, 1917. Countermeasures taken on July 25th after final confirmation. Results were mixed. Accounts collected from witnesses indicate that the constructs were not completely destroyed as hoped, only partially melted. This is likely due to the low ratio of construct source steel to regular steel in the toy soldiers provided. However, the constructs were hindered by their misshapen forms, and some were disabled completely when key parts of the script written across their faces and chests melted. Delilah S. relocated and reassigned. Wowie. That was different. I mean, don't get me wrong, a lot of knights back then saw some truly harrowing magic and did some truly grisly things, but this is different. Relocated and reassigned? Perhaps they recruited her. She did do some impressive work. That might explain why the higher level officers were there too. Maybe they had to hear it for themselves. Well, I've been organizing these files as I go along, and I'm not altogether sure where to put this one. I'll set it in the civilian statements for now.
The Harrowing of Minerva Damson and its related stories are written, narrated, and produced by Jessica Linkhart, and features additional voice work by Miranda Lewis, Claire Miller, and Jamie Sykes. Art assets done in collaboration with Mitch Lewis. Thank you for listening. Our tale will continue next week.